This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Saturday, November 19th, 2022. I'm Ryan Schmelz. President Biden traveling overseas and meeting with a number of different world leaders, most notably his first in-person meeting with President Xi Jinping of China. What is the fallout from the meeting? And what is the current status of the U.S. relationship with China and other countries?
China buys Russian energy and is helping Russia keep that war going in Ukraine and, of course, refuses to condemn it in any way.
I'm Jared Halpern. A changing of the guard in the U.S. House as Speaker Pelosi steps aside and Republicans prepare to lead.
For me, the hours come for a new generation to lead the Democratic caucus.
Washington now has a check and balance. The American people have a say in their government.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. World leaders came together for the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia, where President Biden met with some key heads of state for the first time, including his first face-to-face talks with the United Kingdom's new prime minister. But many eyes were on his meeting with President Xi Jinping of China, as the relationship with the country has significant consequences related to national security and the economy.
I think Team Biden says one of the key takeaways is a tentative agreement to have Secretary of State Antony Blinken visit China early next year.
Dr. Rebecca Grant is a Fox News contributor and president of Iris Independent Research.
I know the State Department really wanted to get those talks going again and get back to talking climate and whatnot. But aside from that, look, it didn't change the reality that China is aggressively competing with America and with the West and with the rules-based order, and that freight train is still pushing forward.
Right. And as this trip was going on, you have FBI Director Christopher Wray calling China the greatest long-term threat. What is China doing that's raising national security concerns, and is it related to nuclear threats, data mining, COVID, et cetera?
All of the above. Let me just touch on two really quickly. FBI Director Wray talked about TikTok, and he just came flat out and said that TikTok could possibly be used as a way to control our phones and spy on our information. And, you know, it's a menace. It's a threat. That's why the military doesn't use TikTok. TSA at the airport can't use it. And moving right to the other end, there's China's nuclear buildup. China's always kept a pretty small nuclear weapons arsenal, but Xi Jinping has them on track to triple the number of warheads. A lot of analysts actually think that China wants to go beyond the U.S. number of warheads, which is about 1,500. There's no reason for this incredible buildup on China's part, both in terms of the actual nuclear weapons and then the missiles and missile fields and other delivery methods. So clearly China is trying to do a nuclear buildup as well. You know, any one of these things would be just a hugely worrying national security threat. And don't forget, of course, China keeps backing Russia in their war in Ukraine.
Right. And we'll get to Russia in just a little bit, too, here. But, you know, when as you talk about China doing this nuclear buildup, you know, does this meeting impact any of the developments in the situation in Taiwan?
In Taiwan, I think they each agreed to, you know, kind of leave things just about as they are. Xi Jinping came out and said that Taiwan was a red line for China, which is no surprise. And Biden pretty much told us that he delivered a strong statement to Xi Jinping. You know, we don't know the exact details. I will say, I think Biden could be a lot stronger on China, but the one area he usually does pretty well is with Taiwan. Biden, as a senator, was involved in writing the Taiwan Relations Act. And so he knows that as president now, he does have the authority to defend Taiwan if the U.S. president chooses. And you can see Biden gives some pretty strong indications that the U.S. will defend Taiwan, but leaves it a little ambiguous. Now, I think Biden needs to do a lot more in terms of arming Taiwan right now and helping to deter China's threat. But basically, the initiative with Taiwan still rests with Xi Jinping and China.
And you mentioned how Biden's made statements, some strong statements on how the U.S. would respond if, in fact, China does invade Taiwan. Now, if that war were to happen, what do you think that means for the United States as of right now?
Well, and really the trick is that military forces have to be in place before anything happens. What everyone worries about, of course, is Taiwan's vibrant economy and their production of critical computer chips. They have some of the world's major industry base in that area, and we could potentially see a shortage or stoppage in computer chip if there is armed conflict around Taiwan. Everybody wants to avoid that. I think in some ways, maybe even China does. But Xi Jinping is not backing down and saying that it's up to China to resolve the Taiwan issue. And so right now, we really have no choice but to make sure we have strong military deterrence around Taiwan as well.
And do you think it is possible for the United States to have a peaceful relationship with the Chinese government?
Yes, I think it is. But we have to understand that it basically is a type of Cold War with a lot of trade thrown in. And our number one priority should be to not give in. We have to take on China in every possible way. We want to make sure our military protection for our forces and our allies out in the Pacific is still strong. And we can't give in on issues like the Chinese intrusions into TikTok. And in intrusions in other parts of our society, there was just another case of a Chinese spy trying to get engine information from GE, which is one of our big engine makers. They're trying to spy on everything that Americans do and all our best technologies. So this is a war that really we have to wage every day in order to keep the peace.
Right. And we mentioned the war in Ukraine earlier. Now, there were reports that Xi Jinping did warn President Putin about using nuclear weapons in Ukraine. But how does China play a role in that war? And what does their relationship look like with Russia?
Russia could never have launched that invasion back in February without Xi Jinping's acquiescence. China buys Russian energy and is helping Russia keep that war going in Ukraine, and of course refuses to condemn it in any way. In fact, China's really extended their alliance and unlimited friendship with Russia. Having said that, that statement's very important. Xi Jinping made the statement unilaterally himself that he did not want to see nuclear weapons used, and then he and Biden confirmed it together. I think this actually is pretty important in Putin's calculation, because she has basically said if a nuclear weapon is used in Ukraine, well, then maybe don't count on China's complete support for Russia anymore. I think that's been actually an enormously important step. We know China's been very startled at Russia's terrible military incompetence and the brutality of this war as it drags on. So I have to say, I was glad to see Xi making a pretty strong statement about no use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine.
And how do you think that background with the war in Ukraine affected that meeting in Bali?
Well, that, you know, I think a question there for the U.S. delegation was to gauge how strong China's support for Russia's war in Ukraine really is. Is China wavering a bit? Are they eager to see Putin try to resolve things? Of course, they're not going to tell us what they saw, but I think with our diplomats that we had there in Bali, they've come away with a much better sense of whether China is still a really strong supporter of Russia in Ukraine, as they say they are, or whether they are actually sending a quiet message to cool it a little bit. And we'll see how that plays out. I am encouraged by the no nuclear weapon statement, but fact remains, a lot of the responsibility for the tragedies in Ukraine has to be laid at China's door as well for supporting it in the first place and backing Russia all this time.
All right. Now, moving on to North Korea. Once again, North Koreans are firing off missiles, and this once again near Japan, which has been rare in recent years, too. You know, defense officials are saying that they have now have the capability of reaching U.S. mainland, and there's already international concern about nuclear threats from Russia. You know, how concerned should we be regarding threats from North Korea right now?
Oh, we need to keep an eye on it. The missile that was launched looks like it might be about 15,000 kilometer range, and that is technically long enough to reach the United States. North Korea has more testing to do on its truly long-range missiles. This was the great thing about the moratorium under the Trump administration, where Kim Jong-un actually just stopped testing long-range missiles. We don't want him to finish the last tests he needs to get the range and the warhead reentry and guidance to give him a true long-range missile threat. But they did two or three long-range launches back in the spring of this year, and then this launch shows us that now North Korea is really back in steady pursuit of a long-range, potentially nuclear-armed weapon. We think they're not quite there yet, but it's really bad news that they've resumed testing. And of course, they've shot off a total of, I think now, 65 missiles this year. That's more than double the number they've done in any other year. Some of those are old 1960s variants that aren't really a military threat to the United States, though they're a threat to allies in the region. But seeing North Korea really try to test and develop this longer range missile, this is a disturbing new development. And of course, the State Department has told us to be on alert for a potential seventh nuclear weapons test by North Korea sometime.
All right. When you mentioned those tests, obviously the United States has also been working closely with Japan as well as the South Korean government. You know, do you think the drills and the exercises that they've been doing there have been effective and are working in terms of keeping all three of those countries ready for anything?
Yes, our forces in Korea are ready to fight tonight. That's their slogan. We're close allies, of course, with South Korea and Japan. Not only the conventional military forces, but there are important theater missile defenses that cover South Korea and cover Japan. And don't forget, we have a limited missile defense system here that covers the United States as well with our ground-based interceptors. So I'm glad to see U.S. forces in Japan and in South Korea exercising as they do routinely to make it clear to Kim Jong-un that he can't just push across that border and he really needs to watch what he does with his military, because South Korea, Japan, and many other allies in the region, I think Australia included, you know, everybody's ready to oppose that. A little bit concerning with South Korea, as we've seen tensions ratchet up a little bit, and this is very provocative on the part of Kim Jong-un. This is the North doing this on purpose. And so it's natural to see the U.S. and forces in South Korea matching that with their heightened exercises and alert levels. It's only appropriate when Kim Jong-un is shooting off missiles.
All right. And you kind of mentioned that, too. But hey, some people listening might think, you know, well, this doesn't seem like it's anything new. It feels like we've had this tension between South Korea and North Korea, as well as the United States, for what seems like decades now. You know, is there anything unique or different about it this time around?
Two different things. Experts think that North Korea is now not just going for missiles, but trying to diversify and perhaps even build its own nuclear triad. They are trying to develop submarine-launched missiles and also to arm aircraft potentially with nuclear weapons. Again, they don't really have all this solved yet, but for them to have an ambition to have a nuclear triad is really a worrying technological development. So, you know, that is really, really difficult to see. And then most of all, North Korea stepping back from what had been a moratorium and a moratorium on testing and a willingness to at least talk about denuclearization. Now all that we see is really heightened activity. And hey, you got to blame China for some of this too. China is North Korea's lifeline. They have a lot of say over what Kim Jong-un does. And I think China is enjoying watching North Korea prod and poke South Korea, Japan, and the United States.
All right. And last question here, you know, given the current tensions across the world, are we close at all to a nuclear war?
No, I don't think that we are. I think our nuclear deterrence is very strong. The Pentagon has consistently said they do not see Russia taking tactical preparations to do anything with their nuclear weapons. No change to that. But what we see is increasing challenges to nuclear deterrence. And that's why The U.S. has to keep its nuclear forces ready, including the important modernization programs, whether that's the Columbia-class new submarine for the Navy, the Air Force's new B-21 bomber, and some work to modernize our ground-based missiles and our nuclear weapons. We must keep that deterrent up to speed, because in this world with more ambitious nuclear actors, our U.S. nuclear deterrence is more important than ever, not just for us, but also for our allies, too.
And she's Dr. Rebecca Grant, a Fox News contributor and president of Iris Independent Research. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Grant.
Thank you.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
When the 118th Congress convenes in January, Democrats will caucus for the first time since 2003, 20 years, without Nancy Pelosi leading them. Pelosi held off on announcing her plans for a political future until this week, when Republicans secured the 218 seats needed to be in the majority in the upcoming Congress.
It's no greater official honor for me than to stand on this floor and to speak for the people of San Francisco. This I will continue to do as a member of the House, speaking for the people of San Francisco, serving the great state of California, and defending our Constitution. And with great confidence in our caucus, I will not seek re-election to Democratic leadership in the next Congress.
So beginning January 3rd, Speaker Pelosi will be again Congresswoman Pelosi. She says it's time for new leadership.
For me, the hour's come for a new generation to lead the Democratic caucus that I so deeply respect. And I'm grateful that so many are ready and willing to shoulder this awesome responsibility.
Pelosi isn't alone in leaving a leadership post. Her longtime number two, Maryland Democrat Steny Hoyer, also won't run for a leadership position. Of course, the House will be controlled by Republicans, who this week officially voted to nominate their leader, Kevin McCarthy, to take the gavel from Pelosi.
Washington now has a check and balance. The American people have a say in their government. And this new Republican leadership team is ready to get to work to put America back on the right track.
But the quote from the musical Hamilton, McCarthy doesn't have the votes, at least not yet, to become Speaker. Fox News congressional correspondent Chad Pergram has covered the careers of both Pelosi and McCarthy. And as always, he provides some history to be our guide about what may be in store for both top lawmakers.
I was told a couple of weeks before the election, and this is before the attack on her husband, that she was 82, she wasn't going to stick around to be minority leader, that she was probably out of here. Then it was pointed out to me, they said, well, but if it's a narrow minority, perhaps she remains here. Okay. And nobody thought we would actually have a minority maybe this narrow. Some people did, but not many.
Not many. It's going to be pretty narrow.
Exactly. So some people thought that that might give her more impetus to stay. Then you had the attack on her husband. Now, you could certainly read this as one way of saying, oh, I need to take care of my husband. This was an attack directed at me. I need to get out of Dodge, whatever. As I said a few times, I said, and I think I said this to you, I didn't know Pelosi's thinking, but I know how she thinks. Right. And I could also see another side of her. And she said this in an interview with CNN, where she and ABC as well, that she, you know, this kind of recalibrated her thinking. And reading between the lines and knowing how Nancy Pelosi does not back down from a fight, knowing how Nancy Pelosi does not want to be seen as weak and would be encouraging women and other women who are aspiring to be leaders to stand up, you don't cower from something like that. And so long as her husband or her family were okay with this, that she might stay. Well, that's not what happened. She is going to continue to be a member of Congress. She will not be the Speaker, obviously, because the Democrats lost the majority. She won't be the minority leader. Steny Hoyer, the same deal. And here's something interesting about Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi. Hoyer was born in New York, but he is really a creature of the state of Maryland. A lot of people forget that Nancy Pelosi is also from Maryland. Her dad was a congressman from Baltimore, Tommy D'Alessandro. So they have been...
And mayor of Baltimore.
Yes.
And her brother was mayor of Baltimore.
Yes. And they have been rivals for a long time. And in fact, a lot of people thought that, you know, Hoyer wanted to be speaker, always wanted to be a leader. He could never get around Pelosi. Those two interned together in the 1960s in the office here on Capitol Hill of Senator Daniel Brewster of Maryland. And Hoyer has never been able to get around Pelosi. And so here we are, that they're both going out the door around the same time.
Well, so let me ask about that, because you're right. It's not just Pelosi who said she's going to step down from leadership. Leader Hoyer said he's not going to run. James Clyburn is not going to run for his current leadership post. Mm-hmm. The top three Democrats in the House of Representatives are going to change. All of them are in their 80s. The people poised to take those positions are in their 40s and 50s. That speaks a lot to where the Democratic Party's moving.
Yeah, exactly. And if Hakeem Jeffries, who's the Democratic Caucus chairman,
and seems to be the outright front runner to succeed Nancy Pelosi as leader of the House Democrats.
That's right. And everybody thought that the odds were leaning that direction anyway. It's very interesting from my perspective to look at the political carcasses that are on the road for years of all the people who were supposed to be the successor to Nancy Pelosi. You know, I'm old enough to remember when Rahm Emanuel, Democratic congressman from Illinois, was the man. And then there was Chris Van Hollen from Maryland, who Pelosi picked to be assistant to the leader, assistant to these kind of, you know, titles to kind of, you know, turn the screw on Hoyer just a little bit, you know. And then you had Steve Israel from New York, who was the chairman of the Democratic Congressional
Campaign.
None of
these people are in the House of Representatives.
Javier Becerra from California, who now is the Health and Human Services Secretary. They have talked about the departure of Nancy Pelosi for 12 years. Everybody thought that she was out the door.
Well, she's been the leader for 20, right?
In 2010, that's right. And here's the interesting thing also about Hoyer and Pelosi leaving. They're both going to continue to be members of Congress. Well, the thing that gave Pelosi the opportunity to become the leader, she was the whip for one term back in the early 2000s, was that Dick Gephardt, who had been both the majority and the minority leader for the Democrats in Missouri, he was going to run for president again in 2004. He ran in 1988, and so he was not going to be the leader, and so she had the opportunity to become leader. So he stayed in Congress for one term as he ran for president as just a rank-and-file member from Missouri. And you know who else did this, too? Now, we don't think very highly these days of former Speaker Denny Hastert because of some of the things that came out about him and abusing children when he was a high school teacher and wrestling coach many, many years ago. And nobody knew any of this definitively during his entire political career and his speakership. But when the Republicans lost the House in 2006, obviously what happens is you go from three major leadership positions, Speaker, Majority Leader, Majority Whip, down to two. Minority Leader and Minority Whip. So somebody gets the squeeze here. And so Hastert, because Republicans were losing the House, they didn't look good because there was actually another issue of a Republican member sending inappropriate text messages to House pages. Yeah. We can talk about this all day if we want. But Hastert announced that he would not be a candidate for any leadership position in the new Congress, which he wasn't. But he continued to serve for almost a year. He was reelected to his House seat. And that's what Nancy Pelosi is going to do. And that's what's going to
happen. That's what I was going to add. I mean, do you see Nancy Pelosi as just, I don't want to use the term backbencher, but a rank and file member in a minority House of Representatives?
Here's what this is really about. I did an interview with Mark Baraback of the Los Angeles Times, who knows Pelosi, and he covers the Bay Area and San Francisco quite closely, in the late summer. I did a story that aired on Fox about Pelosi and if she would leave and who might succeed her and everything else. And so I asked Mark this kind of open-ended question about, well, you know, the sources here on Capitol Hill, they kept saying, well, Chad, she wants to set things up so that she has a clear line of succession. And so I'm thinking, well, that's not clear. You know, for a while, it was the clear line of succession, although there might have been a fight between Steve Israel and Sidney Hoyer or Javier Becerra Rahm Emanuel.
Where this is going. But it seems like it's more clear now with Hakeem Jeffries.
It is. But Mark looked at this completely through a different prism, and it was very educational to me. He immediately began talking about San Francisco and the district that she represents. He didn't say anything about setting up a successor in the leadership here in Capitol Hill, the way reporters who cover Congress would. He was talking about, does her daughter, Christine, run for the seat, that she wants to make sure that seat is set up in appropriate hands, not necessarily that the fix is in for her daughter.
The thinking is, like, maybe she doesn't serve the full 2 years, but she serves long enough to to help somebody set up a campaign or sees what kind of Democrats may come forward.
Right, exactly. To make sure that the seat is left in solid hands from her perspective.
Is that how you see Steny Hoyer? I mean, is he gonna be just a rank and file member of Congress in the minority party?
Well, you know, this reminds me of what happened with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So, you know, Bruce Arians was the head coach, right. And then they brought in Tom Brady. And then all of a sudden, Bruce Arians was not the head coach anymore, and they had somebody else. So, you know, you have to deal with Tom Brady. So here's the problem that Leader Jeffries might have.
Right.
Do you have, you know, elder statesmen Pelosi and Hoyer breathing down their neck? I remember this
like a shadow leadership.
I remember this happening in the Senate in 1995. So Tom Daschle from South Dakota became the minority leader. And so prior to that, Robert Byrd had stepped away after George Mitchell became the majority leader because Byrd was just going to chair the Appropriations Committee. One of the most unique moments I've ever seen here on Capitol Hill is there was a debate about the constitutional amendment in 1995, February of 95, on the balanced budget amendment. And Bob Dole, who was the Republican leader, without consultation with the other side, just said, we're not going to vote tonight and change the vote because he didn't have the votes. Byrd went crazy. And I see in the chamber Tom Daschle, who's been the Democratic leader for a hot minute. This is February of 95, so less than 2 months. And he's just like, this is Robert Byrd. I can't, you know. And Robert Byrd held forth on the Senate floor and tore into Bob Dole and tore into the Senate Republicans. And it was like the Jedi Master and the Apprentice, you know. And Tom Daschle at that point, he was not the Jedi Master. Robert Byrd was the Jedi Master. And there was nothing he could say or do. It was Robert Byrd was going to do whatever Robert Byrd was going to do.
Well, and that's what I was kind of wondering, you know, because in the House, there's this tradition of the 1 minute speeches. You get 1 minute and it doesn't apply to the leaders. It doesn't apply to the speaker. It doesn't apply to the Republican and Democratic leader. Nancy Pelosi has not had to give a 1 minute speech in quite some time.
Mm-hmm. And do they?
Will she give a 1 minute speech, Jen?
See, these things aren't written down, Jared. Will they defer to her as she goes over? You know, there is something that they will create up here, the office of the former speaker.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Denny Hastert had that. Paul Ryan had that. John, because you have papers, documents.
Get some digs, okay.
You have some things like this. And it's just out of respect. I remember now, well, we haven't asked this question. You know, she is not exactly on the Christmas card list of Kevin McCarthy, the supposed incoming speaker in the House next year. And so this is up to the Republicans to create that office and everything. Do they actually do that? I don't know. I mean, there is such animus between them. You know, she had cordial relationships with Paul Ryan, more than cordial with John Boehner, frankly.
Pretty close.
You know, less so with Paul Ryan, but, you know, they were kind of on the same page about running the place. She is not on the same page with Kevin McCarthy. And so maybe they don't do those things. I don't know. And there's a big just truckload of papers that leave the building one night. I don't know.
Let me ask. We know how that turns out. Let me ask about Kevin McCarthy. How does he get 31 votes between today and January 3rd? From Republicans. I don't think any Democrats are going to help him out.
I spoke to one member a few days ago and said he will have to get there because he is the only alternative. They said there was no Paul Ryan. See, that's what happened in 2015, is that there were other Republicans, be it Paul Ryan or somebody else, who they thought could step into the fold and be the speaker. Now, it only got to Paul Ryan, but there were, you know, could they have elected Speaker Chaffetz or Speaker Gowdy or Speaker McCall? You know, there were a few other names batted around here. Maybe. We don't know. Somewhere in an alternative timeline that might exist. There is nobody else right now, at least not so far. But Jared, and I've talked about this a million times, it might not work out still because leadership elections are not about partisan politics. They're about particle politics, where they decide who gets into leadership, and it's based on these subatomic political particles and a vote here, a vote there, a move there. We've had, I talked about all the people who were supposed to succeed Pelosi.
Right.
Oh, I'm old enough to remember when Eric Cantor was supposed to be. And Paul Ryan said right after Kevin McCarthy dropped out that he would not be a candidate for speaker. And 2 weeks later, he was the speaker.
They gave like that Sherman-esque pledge.
Yes. I remember also there was a guy from Western New York, Tom Reynolds, who was supposed to be the speaker, maybe because Tom DeLay had problems and maybe Hastert. You see,
but the issue is he's got to get there, and he's got to get there by trying to craft a rules package that appeases not just the House Freedom Caucus, but I think about some of these majority-making Republicans that were just elected in New York and California.
Which naturally undercuts his authority as Speaker.
Yeah.
They are asking for all these other things that they want to have control of the schedule. They want to...
Committee assignments.
Right. And it's not like, you know, there's a little bit of a misnomer out there right now that the Republican conference is only driven by the right wing. For the most part, it is. And you're going to have these louder voices, mm-hmm. the Marjorie Taylor Greens and so on in the Freedom Caucus. But there are some moderates still in there. And they're going to want to fund Ukraine.
Yeah.
And they're not going to want to shut down the government. And they're going to realize, that, you know, the importance of raising the debt ceiling. And these New York Republicans that they have, don't forget that they represent all these Wall Street bankers.
That's right.
And they're going to come to them and say, if you don't raise the debt ceiling, do you realize what's going to happen to our firms on Wall
and
Street?
And that's an opportunity for Democrats who only need two or three or four Republican votes.
Yep, absolutely. And this is why this is a very tough equation. So McCarthy might have to promise some things and then doesn't make good on them. And if he doesn't make good on them, what happens? Now, there's something that they have talked about retaining is the motion to vacate the chair, which means that the leadership at any point in time can just call a leadership election in the middle of a Congress, which is very foreign. We usually elect the speaker.
I mean, essentially, it's in a parliamentary sense, almost a vote of confidence, a non-confidence vote.
It's very much something like, and it had really never been used at all. And Mark Meadows, when he was a member from North Carolina, kind of used this as a sort of Damocles over John Boehner. And
then Paul Ryan.
Exactly. But mostly that's the reason John Boehner hit the exit here, because he realized that this was going to cave in on him at some point. And so the other thing about Kevin McCarthy, you know, which makes me wonder, is this not a battle that wasn't fought in 2015 that is being fought now? In other words, that he did not have the votes then, and this battle was just delayed by 7 years. And maybe it plays out now. Does he prevail? Does he not? It's really hard to say. I mean, 30 votes. Now he's not really at a 30-vote deficit because there's some people who said, this is...
Yeah, obviously they're going to vote for him.
This isn't the real vote. Yeah. And, you know, but there's probably a good 9 to 12, maybe, who probably wouldn't vote for it. And, you know, if they get up to, you know, 223, 221, he doesn't have many, you know, seats at all to mess with. And you have to have an outright majority of the entire House. But you and I, many years ago, we talked about Galusha Groh.
I remember.
Who was the only speaker prior to Tom Foley to actually lose his leadership in his district. So two members, two names I want you to remember now. Hal Cobb of Georgia, and Nathaniel Banks of Massachusetts, 1849, 1856, respectively. These were their speakers' races. Neither could get an outright majority of the entire House. They voted for 63 ballots with Cobb and 133 ballots over 2 months, mind you. 2 months, mind you. And it's not like the House goes off and does other things. You can't do anything till you elect a speaker, Jared. So what they finally did in both cases, they were getting, you know, on the outer rims of all these votes and everything, and they said, okay, if we don't have a majority, an outright majority, what we would do on the next third or fourth ballot, we will pass a resolution that says the speaker is elected by just a simple majority, which is what they did. And then they actually elected, kind of certifying Cobb and then later Banks as the speaker. So they could do that. Has not been done, even in the case of Frederick Gillette of Massachusetts, who was speaker in 1923. That's the last speaker's race to go to a second ballot. In fact, it went to 9 ballots and took about 2 days. So we might sit around here for a couple of days. And maybe McCarthy's closing argument is, you want to investigate Joe Biden? You want to look at Hunter Biden's laptop? We can't do any of those things until you elect me. And that might be his closing argument if we get down 2-3 ballots, 2-3 days, et cetera.
I just want to point out here as we close that Chad Pergram gave all of those examples of history without a single note in front of him. Well done, sir.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, with the Commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, Christopher Magnus, stepping down from his position, what does the future hold for immigration policy under the Biden administration? And with former President Donald Trump's announcement to run again in 2024, what other potential candidates could make their case for the White House? Until then, I'm Ryan Schmelz. Thank you for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington. please rate and review this podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.